And welcome to another episode of Ravage Critics, joined currently this evening by Obi. How are you?
Happy and hairy. How are you?
happy and smooth? No, happy. No, I'm joking. Yeah, all good, thanks. So it feels like a while since we've podded. Pods have been recorded, but sitting on some production queues, so... Yep, we've released one that you and Chris did, and we've got one which we talk about Barbie and Oppenheimer, so we are trying to have our finger on the pulse. We've got a few new releases to come out that we're going to chat about, and some stuff that's series-wise that's out as well. I guess film news-wise, things are quite slow because of the strikes, so nothing's really being announced.
You think it's been pushed back, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of the Marvel stuff, well, I think pretty much everything's being pushed back, understandably, because there's no one who's really legally allowed to work on it. But Adam Driver came out recently. He was promoting some small film. I think there are some exceptions to what you're, you know, allowed to promote based on the size of the production, maybe. And he was basically saying that, yeah, he's promoting that film, and that studio or small production company were willing to give the actors and production crew what they were asking for. And he was like, if this small studio can do it, why can't Netflix and Amazon and all the others? Which is a fair point. So, wasn't there something about, was it the Flash guy, Stephen Amell, who was a bit, maybe some of his comments were not well received about this strike?
Yeah, he said, I think he said, like, striking isn't the right way to get the result they want, or something of that, I think basically he said he didn't support people striking, I think. Either striking or protesting, one of those. And then, yeah, everybody started going after him.
Yeah.
I have no idea if the comments were, like, lost in context, but from what he, from the quotes that I saw, it didn't look like the most supportive statement.
No, and, you know, he's probably fortunate enough to be getting work regularly enough that the kind of what the people are protesting for is maybe something he doesn't have to consider too much. But, you know, it's all about solidarity. So hopefully there can be a resolution for that. And so we, as the audience, can get to watch it. But, have we talked about the most recent Loki trailer?
No, I haven't seen it, so enlighten me, please.
Oh, well, it's coming out in about a month. I don't know if you've seen any trailers for it, but the most recent one is pretty similar to the last one. But there is, that, you know, they still have Jonathan Majors' character, Victor Timely, as, you know, relatively kind of front and, not front and centre, but he, it's not as if they're trying to reduce his involvement. Which I guess, you know, I don't know how much of a big character that character is going to be in Loki season two. I'd imagine fairly large one. So it's not as if they can sort of pretend it doesn't exist. But yeah, I mean, I think it looks quite good. I'm looking forward to it. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, does it worry you at all that the showrunners from the season one are completely different to this season?
I couldn't tell you who they were, but...
No, it's an English woman, that's all I remember. Kate something, I think.
Okay. But, I mean, you know, season one was good. You do always... I think there's always a noticeable difference in quality and difference... doesn't necessarily mean worse when showrunners change. But I don't know. I think sometimes having the same creative people is a good thing. Sometimes change is also good. Depends on the reason. If it's like creative differences, I don't know. If it was sort of like, if it was a, I know they're directors rather than showrunners, but if it was a case that the Russos left Endgame during production because of creative differences, I'd be like, oh, okay, well, they're integral from, you know, Infinity War. is the same true of Loki, considering he's been a character, you know, basically from the very inception of the MCU. I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean, I think from what I've seen, it still looks pretty cool. I'm excited for it. I'm looking forward to it. I wouldn't say excited. I'm also, actually, surprisingly to myself, looking forward to the Marvels.
Same.
The most recent kind of stuff they've been putting out about it makes it look fun. It kind of explains it a little bit better about, like, how it's all going to work. I think Iman Vellani seems to just have quite an infectious character. And apparently, according to, I was going to say the Twitter sphere, the X sphere, I'm just going to call it Twitter, the Twitter sphere. Apparently it's an hour 47, which I think would make it the shortest or one of the shortest MCU films.
That's mad short.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they've probably got a lot to cover, but if Neil deCosta can do it succinctly with, you know, cut all the fat off, then cool, you know. Superhero films don't need to be 2 hours, 2.5 hours, if she can tell her story in an hour 47. Cool.
Yeah, no, I completely hear what you're saying, to be fair. I think, apologies, what's the actress' name? Iman?
Vellani, I think.
Vellani. She, I feel like, is just going to be like, is probably going to be like the breakout star of the film. Not, so she's already broken out, I guess, she's in Miss Marvel. But she kind of like, she reminds me of Tom Holland a bit, Tom Holland Spider-Man a bit. Infectious character who, like, their enthusiasm kind of like makes you like gravitate towards them.
Yeah.
And yeah, I feel like she's probably going to stand out quite a lot in this film. And I hope it's fun, but I hope it's not Thor Love and Thunder type of fun, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, where, to me, that bordered on just stupidity, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like, and that wasn't, it's not really my sort. It's, I think that was like Taika Waititi leveled up times 100 kind of thing, which is not really my sort of humor. And I think, yeah, Nia DaCosta said that the film is like really wacky and stuff, but I hope it's not overbearing, if that makes sense. Like, I hope the story matters more than making jokes, if that makes sense.
Yeah, wacky's fine, silly, no.
Mm.
Also, the writers of, I want to say, Kang Dynasty and Secret Wars, I think they were due to be the same, writers have left. The writers, I think they also did Ant-Man Quantumania, so them leaving is not really...
Yeah, I'm not mad at that.
I'm not mad at that. No word on who will replace them. I saw today, again, on the X-Sphere, that... Marvel want Sam Raimi to direct Secret Wars.
Oh, I don't know about that either.
I think Multiverse of Madness, the horror kind of inflection, makes sense for Sam Raimi.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't even... because the MCU Secret Wars is going to be such a climactic film... hopefully. The only people I can think of that you would probably trust are the Russos.
Yeah, literally what I was thinking.
So yeah, would they go back to an X? I don't know.
Mm. Are they done with Marvel now, the Russos?
I don't know. I think, you know, money talks.
Yeah.
So I'm sure, I'm not sure much of their subsequent stuff has really... blown anyone out of the water.
It hasn't been. Well, the people love they're behind Extraction, right?
Yeah, I think they produce it rather than direct it, but you know, I think people would be very happy for them to come back to Marvel. Mm. But yeah, you know, we will see. I mean, it was due to be out 2026. It's probably going to be at least 2027.
So far away.
I know, but yeah, I think the only stuff that's coming out this year is Loki and the Marvels, I believe. Mm. And do you know there's a certain Aquaman 2 coming out in 3 months?
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Is that not getting pushed back as well?
I've not heard anything.
Completely.
I've not heard anything as if I'm like a fucking industry expert, but, you know, I've not seen anything online to suggest it.
That film might make negative money.
I mean, have you seen any promotion for it?
None at all. There should be a trailer at least, surely.
Baffling to me that, like, you can... Yeah, I mean, the first one made over $1 billion. I know, obviously, DCU stock has fallen, but they kind of just seem to be having the attitude of, like, oh, fuck it, we're not carrying on with any of these characters anyway, so just tank it. But you sort of think, again, I think I've said this before, I think you've said it, how bad must they have thought Batgirl was?
Yeah.
To not release it, to just be like, nah, we're just gonna take the tax write off because, well, we'll talk about Blue Beetle, but The Flash was not good.
No.
So for it to, you know, possibly be worse than that is quite an indictment.
Definitely, and I think like it's all this Snyder Cut stuff has got me thinking like, oh no, I want to see it. Like, I have to see it. Now that you told me that it was that bad, I have to see it. I feel like eventually maybe somebody will find a way to get around it so we can find a cut of it somehow. Because it can't be that bad. Like I've seen some of the worst DC films. Like, to me, it can't be worse than, like, I don't know, fucking Batman and Robin. Do you know what I mean? Like, it can't be worse than that, you know, in my eyes. Or maybe, like, I don't know, the production value just looks crap or something. I don't know. But it was supposed to be a HBO Max straight to streaming thing, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so it can't have been that bad. He spent $90 million on it. Well, I don't know. Maybe it didn't make any sense. Maybe it was baffling.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, David Ayer is basically, you know, insistent that his cut of Suicide Squad actually makes sense.
True.
I hope we get that version. Like, I am one of the people who are not hot on Suicide Squad, but I don't think it's terrible, but yeah, it certainly could do with a lot of tidying up. So release the Ayer cut, really.
Agreed. So, like, quickly, yeah, I think I find it funny when that people have, because I've seen, like, online people have, like, problems with directors wanting to, like, release, like, for example, David Ayer wanting to release his version of the film, and people are like, oh, let it die, let it rest, blah, blah. But I was thinking, like, if it was you and you had, like, a project that you'd worked on for however long, and then the version of that project that got out was completely different to, maybe not completely different, but drastically different to what you wanted for it, surely you would want the same thing. You'd want to see that kind of, your vision see the light of day as well.
Yeah, 100%. You know, these, and the thing is he gets all the criticism for that film.
Yeah, exactly.
And so he's basically trying to salvage his reputation because he was coming off of Fury, End of Watch, you know, some well-received films. He does Suicide Squad, which he thought he'd done like an, you know, sort of moody, introspective piece that DC just cut into, you know, after, I think it was it the success of Deadpool? Something around that time made them be like, ah, we need to make this fun.
I think it was Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, okay. And then they were just like, yeah, cut it to death and
yeah.
Add...
Did he also do Brightburn? Or am I, not Brightburn. Bright. The Will Smith one. Or am I making that up?
Yeah, I think he did.
I like that film. I bet you didn't like it. But I thought it was pretty good. Yeah.
So yeah, release the Ayer cut. Shall we talk about Blue Beetle then? Have you seen it?
I have seen it, yes.
So this is the... It's a DCEU. Yes. So Wiki calls it the 14th installment of the DCEU. Although I think James Gunn in an interview has said that Blue Beetle is the first DCU character, but Blue Beetle is not the first DCU film, which to me is basically him trying to, I guess, be nice and be like, yeah, we're gonna have Blue Beetle in our universe. Yeah. But no, this is not the first film.
Yeah.
Not launched my film. No. So this again is the weird DC perineum where it's sort of like, you know, all these films falling into the gooch of
the gooch.
DCEU and DCU. Essentially we have a Latin American superhero, Jaime Reyes, hometown of Palmyra City, which seems to be based on the Florida Keys. He's a uni grad and goes back home from Gotham University to Palmyra City, and his family are struggling. Their industry, auto parts business, has sort of gone under. The family is struggling financially. The area is being, gentrified against their will by Cord Industries, sort of like a generic, you know, any sort of superhero film has these generic evil businesses, which is headed up by Susan Sarandon's Victoria Cord. Her niece is Jenny, and her father used to be CEO, but mysteriously her father disappeared as he was about to inherit the company. So we've got our bad guys, we've got our family and our hero. He has like a meet cute with Jenny, who's a very rich, rich kind of nepo baby, and he sort of helps her out, sort of stands up for her in a situation that leads her to go, do you know what? If you need a job, come to meet me in Cord Industries office and I'll get you a job. And anyway, at the same time, Victoria Cord has been trying to find the Scarab Beetle, which has powers that will help her power her sort of RoboCop style police force that she wants to introduce. Jenny finds the Beetle in the office, gives it to Jaime to hide, which he does. She says, don't open it, which he does. And the Beetle chooses him as its next champion and infuses it with his body. And then he basically becomes a blue Iron Man with Spider-Man's kind of automatic legs, basically how I viewed it. I think the suit was quite cool. I think the way that it materializes is very cool. And then you've essentially got this villain who wants to get the Beetle back. He's trying to protect the Beetle, his family. You know, you know how this film's going, and you probably know how this film ends, but because this film is very generic. I mean, look, a lot of superhero films are also generic, so, you know, but I don't know. I just think it didn't work for me. I think it's great that they've got Latin American representation. There's definitely some humor in it that probably missed me, because I found the uncle character, Rudy, played by George Lopez, just insufferable. I could not fucking stand him. He was just so irritating. But he is a very well-known Latin American comedian. So, and I think in the credits it was like, and George Lopez, or with George Lopez.
Yeah.
And so he clearly has quite like a big reputation. But, I mean, I found a lot of the family stuff just really dull and boring and annoying. Which, you know, I'm fully holding my hands up and saying it could be cultural. But yeah, I mean, I thought, this sounds harsh, but I thought the actress who played Jenny was really bad.
Oh, same. Oh my God.
She just had no personality whatsoever. Oh, and yeah, she was not good in the role. I thought, Cholo Maradueña as Jaime, was really good. He's very infectious and clearly loving the role, but he was the standout. Everybody else really didn't deliver. And yeah, I think again, it's tough to care about this sort of film when you know that it's really inconsequential to the wider story. Yeah, I don't know. What did you think?
I'm in pretty similar boat to you, to be fair. I thought it was cool. I probably won't watch it again. I think it was, yeah, it was super, super generic. Like, pretty much, apart from, like, the Latin American representation and, like, the cultural references in that regard, everything aside from that was literally copy and pasted from any other film I've seen in the past 20, superhero film I've seen in the past 20 years. It felt very, straight to streaming, Disney Plus original movie kind of like vibe to it. I'm convinced Susan Sarandon was just there for a paycheck. Again, I'm a bit different in terms of the family. I like the family. I like the family aspect of it. I thought George Lopez was funny at times, but not. But it was the jokes were quite hit and miss. The suit looked really cool. I thought they made a mistake in terms of I think the action sequences were like not, again, generic, not inventive in my opinion at all. Especially for a character who according to the Scarab can make anything. I didn't think they were very inventive with the fights or with the weapons. And again, it goes to that thing of like, oh, who's he going to fight at the end? Oh, okay, it's just another version of himself, but in a different color. Cool. Haven't seen that 1,000 times before. I also think they made a mistake in terms of like the Scarab. They don't talk about like really about the Scarab and where it comes from and like the planet it comes from, what it does and, you know, stuff like that. So like my introduction to Blue Beetle was Young Justice, the cartoon, which is Jaime Reyes as well. And in that, they do kind of like delve a little bit deeper into kind of like where the Scarab comes from and kind of like what their purpose of the Scarab is and kind of like what they want to do, which I don't think, apart from a couple of sentences here and there, they did in this very much. And they also didn't give the Scarab much of a person. I can't remember the name of it, her. They didn't give her much personality either. So like when you think about like, for example, Iron Man, even Spider-Man with Karen, and even Venom, actually, for a matter of fact, like, this inner monologue in their head, they are interacting with them, and they're having conversations, and, like, has a personality, and it can make for some funny moments, tense moments, etc. But this, it was just very much, like, a generic, like, oh, yeah, like, robotic voice saying, okay, I'm going to do this now. Now I'm going to do this. And now, at the end, I'm going to speak Spanish, because now we've bonded. And it's just like, that didn't really work for me at all. The dad dying, to be fair, that got me. I thought that was pretty emotional. And then the scene where Jaime reimagines him in heaven. Oh, I don't know if he's reimagined or if that was real. I have no idea. That was a good scene. I liked that. I liked the family moments with the grandma. I thought she was pretty funny. And the bits where she was like to the rest of the family, like, We'll cry later. Like, for now, we have to go and rescue Jaime. And then, obviously, after they rescue him, they're like, okay, now we can cry. Like, now we can mourn the loss of the dad kind of thing. I enjoyed all that. So, yeah, everything I enjoyed pretty much points to the family aspects of it. In terms of the aesthetic, yeah, like I said, I liked the suit. I liked the vibrancy. I think that's even a word. The neon lights of like Palmera City and all stuff like that. I thought that was really cool and kind of made it feel like its own like its own little world, I guess. Which in the bigger scheme of things, in terms of like DC Universe, I think it's cool to kind of have different cities that have different all different feels to them visually and kind of like aesthetically. But yeah, that's all like everything that I'm complimenting that has like nothing to do with like the story because. It's just like, you know, paint by numbers, I would say. And yes, at the end of the day, it's quite a forgettable film. I don't think I'll ever revisit it again. But I wouldn't mind seeing Jaime, his character, again, in future DC projects.
Yeah, I think now that we're so inundated with superhero films, it's really tough to be original. But yeah. I feel like when Black Panther came out, you were like, this is very much a black superhero film.
Mm.
And there were things in it which, I guess, set it apart from, you know, it wasn't just you could replace the main character from Family with any other sort of family and it would basically be the same film. Mm. And even, you know, when he loses his father and then sees him in, like, heaven, you're going, that happened in Black Panther. You know, there's lots of beats in this film. The suit, like I said, looks like Iron Man first and Spider-Man mashup. I really like the design of the suit, but, you know, you look at it and go, oh, it looks like that. Maybe it's comic accurate. Maybe the comic came out before in the Iron Man or Spider-Man. You know, that could be me being unfair. But, you know, you look at these things and you go, oh, I can see that and I can see that. I hated the grandma with that big machine gun thing.
I think that bit in particular was very much, you'll either love that bit or hate that bit. I enjoyed it, I would say. I thought it was funny.
But also, what confuses me about the whole Scarab, like, you're definitely right, they didn't get into it enough, because the opening of the film is them finding the Scarab. But then I'm almost certain in dialogue they say that Ted had the Scarab, and so it wasn't lost.
Mm.
They've had it the whole time. They just, I don't know, were trying to figure out how to get the energy out of it. So to me that seemed like a bit of a plot hole. It was like you didn't actually really need to find it.
Yeah. It was quite confusing as well. Yeah, I didn't really get that either, to be honest.
There was nothing about, like, where it came from. They just said, oh, yeah, it's an alien, you know, this, we've checked all these sites and it's here.
Yeah.
You go, oh, well, where did it come from? Is it, you know, Kryptonian? Is it blah, blah, blah? You know, it's just, oh, look, we've got a Scarab and it chooses its host. Like, why did it choose Jaime over Ted?
Yeah.
How many other Blue Beetles have there been? There's a lot that you probably would want to delve in deeper and it would have been a lot more interesting. Mm.
I was going to ask quickly, like, you know the bad guy in Red Commas?
Yeah.
I would say, like, just quick aside from what the point I was actually about to make, was I found, I don't know if this is the correct thing to say, but when he started dragging Susan Sarandon into the fire, I was cracking up. I'm not going to laugh, but I was hilarious. But yeah, what I was going to say was, how old is this guy? Because you see where Jaime's about to kill him, and then it all flashes back to, like, his life and whatnot. And I swear, like, Susan Sarandon finds him as a child or something.
Am I making that?
And he's like her age, no? He's there.
Well, I think he's had a tough life, Obi.
Maybe, yeah, probably in that, yeah, fair enough. Like, even that bit, I think, was I don't know if contrived is the word, but it just felt like, oh, we need to kind of make this guy sympathetic really quickly. Let's just do this 5-minute long flashback. And it was just like, I don't know, it just felt like really, what's the word? Really cheap. Storytelling, I guess, kind of like, we need to kind of like figure out a way to make us so we care about this guy even for just a minute, and like you just throw all this sympathetic stuff with sympathetic music in the background, and yeah, it just felt a bit contrived to me.
Well, who saw it coming that Ted is still alive?
Oh god, yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine that's ever going to get resolved. So yeah, I think it's very mid film. I mean,
where would you rank this amongst, like, the DC films that you can remember, kind of thing?
I'm just quite ambivalent about it. I see there's parts of Flash that I liked more.
Mm.
But there's also parts of Flash that I think were, like, heinous.
Yeah, heinous.
So, again, like, this is a very mid film.
Yeah.
Just, like, consistently mid, whereas Flash had, like, highs and lows. So, I it's probably one of the... I've not seen Wonder Woman 2048, whatever it is.
Have you not?
Nah, wow. Man. You no, gave bro, it a I terrible
shit.
Review.
I feel and shit.
2.5 hours long, bro.
Like, I'm awful.
But, so I would probably say it's lower end.
Yeah.
Yeah, how would you rank it?
I am... So, yeah, it's this film's definitely towards the lower end. I wouldn't say the film's bad, but I just think it's, yeah, towards the lower end of films. And I'm debating... I think it's better than Shazam Fury of the Gods, I think.
Oh, do you know, I forgot about that film. Yeah, that film's terrible.
That came out this year as well. That film's rubbish.
Shit.
I think I prefer The Flash to Blue Beetle. And I think I'm debating if it's better. It's definitely better than Wonder Woman 1984. That film's terrible as well. I'm debating if it's better than the first Suicide Squad.
I think I prefer the first Suicide Squad, but...
I think I do as well, you know.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I think it's probably, like, fourth worst film out of, like, 14.
Yeah. And considering it is just mid, like, that says quite a lot. But I don't think there's, like, massive highs and lows within the DCEU. A lot of them are just sort of, like, 6 out of 10.
That's fair.
Which, you know, really doesn't say much for that franchise, unfortunately. And this film, according to the eminently trustworthy source Wikipedia, cost $104 million to make, which is actually quite low, and has made so far $105 million.
I'm surprised it's made that much.
Wow, I mean, it's still gonna run at a loss.
Yeah,
I mean, I think Black Adam was actually profitable.
In comparison to the rest of these, Black Adam was pretty successful.
Yeah, The Rock must be so smug right now, because Shazam Fury of the Gods flopped, The Flash definitely flopped, this flopped, and the fact that they're not even bothering to market Aquaman 2, that's going to hemorrhage money.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the amount of pressure on Superman Legacy is insane.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how much they're going to budget that film at. You'd imagine at least 200. But if that film doesn't push 700-800 million, I don't think the DCU's going to... They're just going to give Matt Reeves the reins and hope that his Batman films keep bringing in a billion.
Yeah. This is such a sad state of affairs, man. Like,
I know.
These films should be so much better than they are. It's so annoying.
It's that Icarus thing, isn't it? You know, they tried to reach too far too soon.
Literally. I was talking about this with my sister the other day, actually. Do you think we'll ever get to a point where, like, people don't want to go and see superhero films kind of thing at the cinema?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And I think we're probably not far away from it.
Yeah.
But you see this trend in Hollywood. You know, things come and go. Like, film noir used to be very popular, and then it dipped away and has a resurgence. And, you know, like, screwball comedies. And remember that period of time in the early noughties where everything had a parody film?
Oh, God. I knew you were going to say that as well.
You had superhero movie, disaster movie.
That is my
love movie or whatever. Sport movie. You know, there's things that are popular for periods of time. I mean, I know you had things like, you did have your Batman films, you did have Blade and things like that, but and you even had like the X-Men and stuff.
X-Men,
but superhero films were not massively popular probably until the Avengers, because I mean, there was a few Hulk films, they didn't really work out. Iron Man did really well, but it was quite a risk for them to be like, hey, we've got two more films coming out and then we're going to have a team up. It was relatively unheard of in Hollywood. So you obviously had punctuations of, you know, Spider-Man and blah, 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 blah. But it's from that point that they just proliferated and you've now got so many of them. So it will have its shelf life. But then it will come back at some point, because it's IP that will make money and other generations will, you know, my son by the time he's interested in watching films, maybe the MCU would have sort of run its course, and maybe by the time he's my age, it'll have picked up again, and someone will go, actually, why don't we reboot this?
Maybe by that time we'll finally get an X-Men film from the MCU.
We might even get Fantastic Four by then.
Oof.
yeah, those ambitious thoughts. But yeah, any more thoughts on Blue Beetle?
Not really. I kind of think I wouldn't. I'm trying to think. Would I? You remember? Sorry, I'm waffling. You remember the Justice Society of America in Black Adam?
Yes.
I'm trying to think. Would I mind him maybe teaming up with them? That might be fun. Maybe if they ever decided to take those characters anywhere, which they probably won't actually, thinking about it. Yeah. But yeah, no more thoughts. The DC is a fucking mess, like we all know already. So.
Why don't you give us a synopsis of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles : Mutant Mayhem?
Yeah. So, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, this is an animated telling of the Turtles from, I think, the franchise started in, what, the 80s, when it was animated. Then you had the live-action ones in the 90s, which, if you've watched recently, are actually really, really bad films. And then, yeah, I think they've had quite a few. Sorry, I'm just going to reel off my head. They had, like, the cartoons, and they had the live-action TV series on Jetix / Fox Kids. Then they had the 2014, 2015 live-action ones, with like Megan Fox and that. And now they've come round and they said, okay, cool. We've seen the success of animated films. We've seen Into the Spider-Verse, et cetera, et cetera. So now we're going to make our kind of like animated version of that. So then this film then basically is its own, it's not like following on from anything. It's like an original telling of the same story, if that makes any sense. And yeah, it follows, four turtles, Michelangelo, Leonardo, Raphael, and Donatello, exposed to ooze, or what did Ice Cube call it? He called it something else. I can't remember what word he used, but I find it quite funny when they're like, ooze sounds better. Anyway, so they were exposed to ooze, which came from a doctor who was experimenting on animals, and he already had like his own mutated animal, which was like a fly kind of thing, and then yeah, he is stopped by police. I can't remember if it's police or if it's other scientists, and yeah, but then some of the ooze escapes. That ooze goes into a sewer, affects a rat, which is Master Splinter, and he is then also affected, but these four turtles are also affected. And he raises these four turtles as his own sons. And they make the point that technically they're all like the same age, but because the turtles were babies and I guess the rat wasn't a baby, he is now older than them and they are teenagers or whatever. And he was like, oh, it makes sense, even though it makes absolutely zero sense. And yeah, Splinter is voiced by Jackie Chan, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
The four turtles are voiced by actual teenagers, I think, or around that age, which I really appreciate, because I feel like this is the first iteration of Ninja Turtles that I've watched where it's not been voiced by adults and they've actually been like actual teenagers, which kind of like lends itself to kind of like the immaturity of it all, which kind of like makes everything a bit more fun. So the plot of this film basically is the Ninja Turtles are hiding from everybody, like in New York City, because obviously they're human-sized turtles. So like, I think the one time that they did try to kind of like expose themselves to the world, everybody kind of hated them and tried to chase them and tried to kill them and whatnot. So then they think like, if we can somehow become heroes, people will love us and we'd be accepted in society, etc., etc. They meet April O'Neil, who is voiced by Ayo Edebiri, who's also in The Bear. And she's like a bit of a loser at school. She wants to be a news reporter, but she threw up on camera, so now she's puke girl or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And she they team up basically to help them help record them the total story of them fighting crime and catching the bad guy, which is Superfly, played by Ice Cube. played by Ice Cube, so that they can become heroes and April can become popular for breaking the story, etc., etc., and they can all be cool. Basically the film follows along. They meet Superfly, who is technically like their cousin, I guess, and he's voiced by Ice Cube, and he's got some henchmen who are also they're all mutants. Some of them, one of them's voiced by Paul Rudd, which had me cracking up in the theater, and a few others. I think John Cena and Seth Rogen are. Oh, I can't remember the name.
Rocksteady and Bebop.
That's the one. Well done, guys.
I just have the list up in front of me.
he voiced them. Superfly's went through the same experience as the Turtles in terms of people in society seeing him and trying to kill him, but instead of running away, he fought them and tried to beat them up. Basically, he wants to make everybody mutants and also enslave humans so that mutants are the oppressors. And the Turtles are like, we're not really sure we're okay with that. And basically they oppose and they fight. They manage to get some of the other mutants on their side. They all go up to fight against Superfly, who takes some ooze and becomes like a giant super mutant, I guess, for lack of a better word. A bit like in Power Rangers when the monsters grow and they have to fight the Megazord and stuff. So then the kids, they all fight Superfly. April overcomes her fear of cameras and is able to kind of like get the media and the people on side to get them to help the turtles to fight Superfly. There was a very big to me anyway. Amazing Spider-Man 2 reference in terms of the people kind of everybody contributing their own little bit to try and help to kind of help the heroes to fight whatever. Eventually they overcome, they defeat Superfly, and then they are recognised as heroes and they are accepted in society and they can go to school and stuff and live their lives. Yeah.
Cool. Good summary.
Ben, what did you think about the film, Glenn?
Our good friend Jack will probably still be pissed off that I'm giving films positive reviews, but I did like it. I really liked the uniqueness of the animation style. At some points, I was like not really sure what I was looking at, but I appreciated the sort of artistic direction that they took. I found it very, I think the only word I can really describe it as is like gnarly. It very much, the animation style fit with the sort of grunginess, the sewer nature of like the Turtles. And at some points it looked like claymation on top of like an oil painting on top of like hand-drawn animation. So yeah, I really appreciated all of the sort of different textures and stuff like that, and as you rightly point out, unlikely to exist without the artistic direction that across the into the Spider-Verse I don't want to say pioneered, because there are definitely animation out there that have really pushed boundaries, but never to a popular degree as Into the Spider-Verse. I liked it. I thought, like you said, the fact that you can tell that the voice actors are the age, of their characters, I think really lends authenticity to it. They all seem to have a decent chemistry, even though it's only voice. Most of the people listed on the voice cast who were, voicing the other mutants were kind of pointless, to be honest. Barely any of them had any lines. A lot of them just looked awful. Well, not awful in the sense of, like, bad animation, but they looked horrendous, which I guess is the point. I liked the best parts for me were the family elements, which is funny considering that was not the part I liked about Blue Beetle. Yeah. But the sort of Splinter trying to hold on to his kids as they're like growing up, the fact that all the Turtles wanted to do was to just be accepted, and actually that's all Superfly ever wanted at the beginning. So those parts I thought were really good. The action, you know, and the fight sequences were sort of, you know, fine. Nothing kind of groundbreaking. But yeah, no, I appreciated it for what it was. And I mean, I you could tell quite early on that they're definitely going to introduce Shredder, as these films always do. You can't have Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles without Shredder. So that's fine. I can imagine it will get a sequel. I just hope they sort of keep the heart, for want of a better term, because I think that was the best part of it for me.
Yeah, I'm pretty much in agreement with you. I enjoyed it a lot. I think it was a lot of fun. I think that, like you said, the best part of the film is the chemistry between the four brothers. I quite enjoyed the fact that, obviously, this is pretty much the case in all of them, but obviously they all have, like, their different personalities. But they're not, like, fully fledged yet. Like, obviously Leonardo's supposed to be, like, the leader, but he doesn't really, like, develop into the leader until, like, the end of it. Donnie's the smart one, but he doesn't really kind of use his intelligence until the end when he comes up like with the plan and stuff like that. I really like how that kind of developed the characters throughout the film. There was one sick action sequence, actually. I think it's the first one where they first go to fight, start fighting like criminals, and like I can't even describe it. They were like interchanging. They were fighting, but they were interchanging the turtles with each other, like as they were fighting different people. I don't know if you remember that at all, but I remember watching that bit and thinking, this is actually proper sick. It's a shame that that was like maybe a third into the film, and that was the best action sequence for me. I thought that Ice Cube has the most distinct voice in Hollywood. he just, every line he said was just cracking me up, because I just could imagine him in real life kind of like in a sound booth just saying all these things, and it just made me laugh. There was like Ice-T reference in there at one point, I think like 6 a.m. police at my door. Which was funny. I think, and that even like, yeah, like I said, the family stuff, like Splinter kind of, when he threw the party for the turtles, and he had like all cutouts, cardboard cutouts of all the crisps.
That was so funny.
Yeah, but that was joke. And I love how modern it is. Like, it's very like, I think they mentioned Endgame in it. Like, they mentioned Attack on Titan. They were talking about all like sorts of like stuff.
I did find that a lot of those like cultural references were kind of getting a bit thin, wearing a bit thin. It was sort of like, yeah, we get this is contemporary. Like, not every sentence needs to be like, oh, this is like that game that everyone's playing at the moment. Who's the fall guy? All that sort of shit. Oh, okay, fine. I got it. I got bored of them by the end, but yes.
That's fair. I think stuff like that does help, like, it would help, I suppose, younger kids maybe connect with the film. Because, like, I imagine, actually, to be honest, I don't really know. Is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles still popular? I have no idea. I feel like
Who's obviously at the edge of what's relevant at the moment, OB, I can tell you that it is not.
Fair.
I don't fucking know, do I?
But, like, I think those sort of references will resonate with people, I think, and it's more likely to kind of, so I imagine they threw a lot of them in there because like, okay, we need to prove that like we're down with the kids, you know. Which I get, and obviously, yeah, it probably was a little bit much, but I didn't mind it. And obviously the references that I did get, I was like, oh yeah, that's funny, that makes sense, and stuff like that. And yeah, I would watch a sequel for sure. And I'm really, yeah, I think, like you said earlier, I'm really glad that kind of like these, I think animated films are starting to get more shine and people aren't like, what's it called? That people aren't put off by the fact that something might be animated, I think. And I think it does help that kind of like when they are like visually like really attractive. I think about films like this and like you say, Into Spider-Verse and Across the Spider-Verse and Mitchell vs. Machines and even Puss in Boots, like, visually, I think
this is actually the same director as Mitchell versus Machines.
Oh, is it? Okay, yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. So, like, I think visually we are kind of getting, we're getting more and more inventive or kind of like visual creativity, which is great to see, to be honest, because I am not a huge animation person, but seeing stuff like this will make me want to go and watch more things like this.
Yeah. I think we're also probably going to get to a point where we have a lot more blending of real life and animation. So you saw parts of it Across the Spider-Verse had a few sort of live action scenes and sequences. Obviously the cardboard cutouts, and there was a couple of like, I guess, live action within the animation. I'm thinking of, was it Ferris Bueller's Day Off they were watching?
I think so, yeah.
So yeah, I think that done well is probably the a next step. You've obviously had things like, is it Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Space Jam and stuff like that, but they're very much like the Looney Tunes style, but kind of blending it as we have done. I also, slight tangent, think Beyond the Spider-Verse will end on a live action note.
I agree. Yeah,
I think it's gonna be like, hey, now we've got Miles Morales.
Yeah, I agree,
which I think would be cool.
That'd be very cool. Yeah,
yeah, cool. I think I might have given it a 7.
I probably agree with that. Yeah,
well, we shall wait for the announcement once the strikes are over, presumably. Do you want to talk first about The Blackening or Equalizer 3?
I'll talk about Equalizer 3 because I won't talk about it for very long.
Yeah, go for it.
The Equalizer 3 is the finale in the Equalizer series. It is the only film that Denzel Washington has done sequels to, which I find quite astonishing. And yeah, it basically follows Robert McCall, played by Denzel Washington, who is like basically an ex-CIA, FBI, you know, Homeland Security, I don't know, assassin, spy or whatever. And he basically goes around pretty much basically kind of like just doing good deeds for people, but in like a really, in really like fucked up settings. And this film's pretty similar, I guess. Do you care if I spoil it?
No, I was going to go and see it, but your review on Instagram, which were your average critics, didn't make me want to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, so the film starts with a pretty cool action scene. Robert McCall's like, he needs to get something from these mafia people, I think, in Sicily. And basically it goes like throughout the house and it shows like all these people he's killed, and he's like, I asked him to let me in, you should have just let me in and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, cool, we're cooking with gas, like we started off hot, like it's gonna be good. And the film just is I think, and I would, if you ever watch it again, I'd love to know if you agree, I think it's unnecessarily violent. It's like showing like corkscrews to the chin, shotguns to the eye. Like, it is.
This film. This was a 15.
Yeah, I'm surprised, to be completely honest. There's not that many action sequences, but the ones that are, they are very, very gory. I think personally, and very detailed in the gore as well. They don't. Sometimes like you can see someone will get shot and the camera will like, turn away. It's like, nah, the camera leans into the fact that this person's getting shot in the face. Yeah. which is an interesting take, because I feel like the other two films weren't this gory. I haven't watched them since they came out, so I can't remember, but yeah, that definitely stuck out to me in this one. But essentially, the film follows Robert McCall as he kind of like searches for where his retirement, basically, where he's supposed to be, in inverted commas, which he says quite a lot in the film. And he settles upon a town in Italy, with nice people who help him. He gets shot in the beginning of the film, and there's a doctor who helps him, there's people who work him to the town, and, you know, give him free food and whatnot, and he feels very welcomed in the community, feels part of the community. In his community, there was also, you know, your typical mafia guy who's running around trying to buy up all, like, people's houses and stuff for cheap so he can build his own stuff, and he's, you know, except getting payments from people for protection, the combos and stuff like that. Very, very generic, I would say. That is all, they are connected to a terrorist organization, I think, from, I don't know, Syria or something, who Robert is involved with at the beginning of the film. And because of that, he calls someone at the CIA to say, oh, anonymous tip, come and look at this. I found this in this place in Sicily. You know, this is potentially dangerous. Come and look at it, blah, blah, blah. This person he calls is Dakota Fanning. So she goes to Sicily with a couple of FBI guys to go and check it out, blah, 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 blah. That side of the story is super irrelevant. Like, you can take it all out and it pretty much makes no difference in the film whatsoever. Dakota Fanning is in maybe three scenes, maybe four scenes throughout the entire film. In one of the scenes in which she almost dies and gets a car blown up. The next scene, she's in hospital. Scene after that, she's home and this whole thing's been solved.
okay. I feel much, it's very much like, oh, do you remember these were together in Man on Fire? Like, yeah. 20 years ago, and look how much she's grown up, and look how Denzel Washington's barely aged.
Literally, that's literally what it felt like. Like, it felt like they were just literally saying, like, oh, yeah, by the way, these two were in the film together, and we know that, and we know that you know that, so let's make it really obvious. Yeah, he has some supporting characters. There's a doctor called Enzo, there's a policeman. There is a woman who's nice to him at the calf. All of these people who are barely having any lines have maybe one or two scenes each. It's all very underdeveloped. Nothing really moves the plot forward in any way in scenes with these people. The film is basically just about Denzel finding a town that he likes, seeing that there's a mafia here, and saying, all right, I want to live here and I want to live here in peace, so I'm going to kill all of these mafia people as violently and as gruesomely as I possibly can, which he does. He meets the mafia guy's brother in a restaurant, breaks his arm, and says, basically tells him to piss off, and then he tells him so this is what I thought was really fucked up. Yeah, he tells the brother to piss off. That the brother pisses off with his broken arm. Then it shows the very next scene, which I can only imagine is maybe like an hour or two later. It shows the brother like preparing to retaliate. Preparing, not retaliating, preparing to retaliate. At which point, Denzel Washington comes through and kills everybody, including the brother. He didn't even give him a chance. He just killed him.
That's efficient storytelling.
Like, it's so stupid. He told him to fuck off. The guy fucked up and he killed him anyway.
Doesn't sound anyway. like one of Denzel's best.
Oh, mate, honestly. And then, yeah, so he kills the brother. And obviously the mafia guy's pissed off now because his brother's dead, right? So then the mafia guy is asking around town, like, who killed my brother? Like, because everybody knows, it's like an open secret. Everybody knows that he was there with Robert, innit? And then Robert comes out into the town square and says, you can take me, like, you just don't harm any of these people. Like, I like this place. Don't, you know, make it worse than it already is. Take me away and I'll do whatever. At which point, if I was the mafia guy, I would have been like, bang, shoot him in the head. Done. Film's done. But anyway, I think at this point, maybe he wants to torture him, whatever. But then everyone, it's like a crowd. There's a crowd full of people. But everybody got their phones out. And then the mafia guys were like, oh, no, we can't let them all video us, you know, torturing this guy because it'll get out and then we'll go to prison, blah, blah. So he's like, cool, I'll find you at some point. Don't matter when, but I'll find you. At which point, Denzel Washington turns a little bit into his character from Training Day and just starts speaking with a certain, like, I don't know, with a certain, like, diction and swagger. And I'm like, what film are you in now? Because you haven't been speaking like this at all in any of the past three films. But now you've turned into, like, flipping Alonzo Harris from Training Day. And I was like, okay, cool, whatever. If we're going to do that, we'll do that. So then he's like, cool, we won't handle this now. But you can have, like, at some point, I will, like, I don't know, surrender myself and, you know, I can have you, whatever. At which point, maybe, I don't know, a day later, Robert goes to this guy, breaks this guy's mansion and kills everybody, violently, and also the mafia guy himself, and watches him die slowly as he, I think he feeds him, like, loads of different pills and makes his heart give out, and, kills him. At which point, then the film's finished. Like, the film pretty much ends there. And you find out that these mafia people were also connected with the terrorists. That they were the cause of the terrorist stuff. It wasn't people in Syria. It was actually the mafia people in Italy, which I guess connects Dakota Fanning and her character. And she's like, oh, we solved the case. Thanks, Robert. Whatever. And then you find out the reason that he was in Syria in the first place, in Sicily in the first place, was to get $366,000. Which a guy he was driving around in an Uber lost. It was his pension, and he lost that amount because of some Ponzi scheme, whatever. And he went to go and collect that money himself to give it back to this man that he didn't really even know. Because he's a good guy, I guess. and yeah, then the film pretty much ends. You find out that Dakota Fanning's mother is friends or worked with Robert. I think she might have been in the first film, but I can't remember that film clearly enough. So yeah, she's like, oh, you knew who I was the whole time. And the film ends. And yeah, he's in Sicily, enjoyed his life. And the film ends.
Okay. I mean, this
is really shit. It's really shit.
It didn't, like, it didn't need to be a trilogy.
No.
You can just end something after two films, or even one. Why, what do you think the appeal for Denzel Washington was of this being the only sequels in his career?
Oh, it's a good question. I think, I can only imagine he really liked playing that character, like the CIA or the ex-Special Ops guy. I can only imagine he just really liked playing that character because it can't be, excuse me, it can't be for the story, for sure. And maybe, I think Antoine Fuqua directed them, and I think he's got quite a good relationship, quite a close relationship with him over the years. So maybe that's why, maybe he's like, I don't know, asked to be in it, and he was like, sure, I'll keep being in them. But that aside, I can't see what the appeal would be.
I feel like there's quite a few actors who, the older they get, they obviously don't get offered the same sort of roles as they used to. But the quality that they end up putting out sort of ends up diminishing their legacy.
Yeah.
I think of, like, Robert De Niro and some of the stuff that he fucking puts out. You know, all these, like, bad grandpa and, like, you know, stuff like that. You just sort of think, don't need the money. I get you might still want to work and stuff, but I don't know. You just sort of think, oh, Robert De Niro. There'll be a generation of people, like, oh, Robert De Niro, he was in The Intern, wasn't it? And you'd be like, well, look, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull. You know, again, that's not my generation, but, you know, you sort of get known for some poor things, and I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying Denzel's in that category yet, but because a lot of the stuff he's done recently, Fences and things like that, are very critically acclaimed. But
some of his last few films have not. I've watched all of them, and they've not been very good.
Roman J. Israel Esquire.
That was bad. He was in the film called The Little Things, also bad. To be fair, I didn't see Macbeth, so I don't know about that one. But he's not trending the right way, I'll say that much.
Yeah, it's a shame, but you know, they just
and I love Denzel Washington, but you know,
I want that generational wealth. Can't knock him for that. The Blackening. So this is a comedy slasher. It's much, much more comedy than it is slasher. Kind of ironically in that spoof kind of genre that we were you know, criticizing earlier, although not to the poor poor quality that they ended up being. This is directed by Tim Story, who's done Barbershop. He also did the original Fantastic Four. Didn't realise that. This is basically taking the piss out of the common horror trope that black characters often die first and often don't survive horror films. This is set on Juneteenth and basically features a reunion of friends from college at a cabin in the woods. And you can sort of see where it's going to end up. The tagline for this film is we can't all die first, which I think is very, very funny. But yeah, I mean, it's relatively generic in a lot of senses. In the sense that, you know, it's a group of friends, there's some internal conflicts, and then they're being picked off by a mysterious killer. The twist is that, you know, they are all black characters, and the kind of title of the film, The Blackening, is in reference to a board game, that they find in the basement, which is kind of like, there was a game that I remember having. It's called Gonna Get Ya. I don't know if it's got loads of different names, but it was essentially like you were being chased by the board game and you had to kind of move along spaces to not be caught. It's kind of like that, but with a very sort of racist doll figure in the middle, and you have to answer questions to keep yourself alive. And the questions are kind of, I guess, stereotyping what black people do and don't kind of interact with on like a cultural level. So I think the first question is, name one black actor or actress or character that survives a horror film. And then, you know, they can't. And then there's the whole sort of piece about, gag about, they don't watch Friends. It's like, I don't watch Friends, but if I did, which, you know, those sorts of things I found quite funny. The plot itself, you know, just being picked off, it doesn't ever really become that gory. A lot of the violence is quite soft. So that's why it's much more comedy than horror. There's a few laughs. I thought the character of Clifton, he was really funny at the beginning, particularly when there's like, is it Shanika's like trying to give him a shot and he just tries to slip it out of her hand.
I was literally going to bring up that exact same thing. I thought that was so funny.
I was crying with laughter. It was so funny. it was just like so stupid. But yeah, I mean, you know, like there weren't really any twists that were like shocking. I liked quite a lot of the characters. I liked Dwayne. Clifton was funny for most part of it. Yeah, I mean, it was fine. I don't necessarily think it doesn't lean into the horror enough. It also doesn't really, like, it does take the piss, but it also, I think, could have gone a lot further. Mm. But yeah, I don't know what you thought of it.
I thought it was okay. I think you probably know, you know, horror is my like least favourite genre of film. So for me to like horror, it probably has to be pretty like extraordinary. I will say the fact that it wasn't like that scary goes a long way with me, so thank you for that. Because I'm a massive wimp when it comes to horror films. I think I liked the concept of the film in terms of like the satire, but I feel like the writing wasn't as clever as it wanted to be, if that makes sense, or as it should have been.
Yeah.
It kind of felt like a lot of it was just like kind of like low hanging fruit, which I get, which is good for like, you know, cheap laughs here and there. But when I think of like, not that it's obviously Get Out's not a comedy, but when I think of like a horror film that's trying to also say something, I think like Get Out's like really, really cleverly written, whereas this was kind of like just okay. You know?
Yeah.
I think a lot of the references, maybe not a lot of the references, some of the references, I think, personally flew over my head, because I think it's more of like a black American experience rather than just a black person experience. So I didn't get a few of the references here and there. Like, I got that I was supposed to get it, but I didn't get it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. The, like you said, some of the characters were all good. Like, I liked all the characters. I liked Dwayne, liked him a lot. I liked, Clifton. And yeah, they all had, like, funny moments here and there. Like you say about the shot bit, I think there was one, like, what does the NAACP stand for? And it was, like, some stupid acronym, and, like, that made me laugh because it was so absurd. Yeah, and I think that the whole ending of it all and the whole, like, I guess who was the killer was really predictable. Like, I guessed from the beginning, and I'm not good at guessing shit like that, but I was like, from the beginning, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, Clifton's the guy who's killing people. Like,
well, yeah, because he was, everyone was like, who are you? Why are you here?
Yeah, he wasn't fucking invited. So, yeah. I actually found it a bit, not weird, but like, I don't know, it'd be odd that they did kill off those two people at the beginning, and I thought we were going to find out that, like, they survived, maybe, but no, they actually died. And I was like, that feels kind of odd.
I also, and this is probably me just overanalyzing, but the fact that, like, the tagline, we can't all die first, and the whole point is that black people are always the first to die in horror films. Mm. The fact that the first person to die in this film was also a black person. Yeah. I don't know if there was an opportunity there to sort of subvert that and have, like, anyone else die first. But maybe I'm just overanalyzing it, and it's just,
I don't think you are, to be honest. I agree. And yeah, I don't know. Just the fact that they were actually dead, just, I found really odd. And also, they never actually, was their name Monica? I think is the woman's name. Maybe it was Monica, maybe it was something else. Or Morgan, I don't know. But she died.
Morgan.
Yeah. Morgan. She died. And they didn't even really show her dying. They kind of just showed her getting trapped in the stairs. And then we just kind of,
yeah,
assumed she was dead, I guess, which I thought was just really, why not show, you showed the man dying, so why not show her dying too? And then, but then we just see her later, like, getting chucked into the well.
Yeah, that's a good point. I found it funny though when they tried to scalp her and it was a wig.
Yeah, that was funny. Yeah, that was funny.
I mean, like you said, it's low hanging fruit. It doesn't push either genre to the extent it could.
No.
But it was funny in parts, and, you know, a couple of good laughs. Only cost $5 million, has made 17, so that probably consider that a success.
Yeah, it was okay.
Cool. I did also watch Scream 6, which came out a few months ago. Yeah. That's a slasher film. It's, again, like, they're much of a muchness. They all follow the same plot, kind of. Kids get targeted, a lot of them end up dying. It's always someone who's relatively known to them, and then you get an explanation, as we did in The Blackening, of, like, why they did it, and there's always some sort of connection back to a previous film. But the Scream films have always been relatively meta, but have got a lot more meta. Particularly Scream 5 was very much self-aware that it was a requel. And this is very much aware that this is a sequel to a requel. And there's a character who, in both Scream 5 and 6, has basically borderline explained, like, what you should expect from the film. It's like, oh, well, this is the sequel to the requel. And, legacy stuff no longer matters. So anyone can die.
Mm.
And it's like, okay, well, I know who's going to die in this film then. But it also could just be red herrings, but it says things like, even the main characters could die. But actually, none of them do, really. So it tries to be clever, but it's never clever enough to actually subvert what you expect, which I think is a real shame, because you obviously, the killers are always revealed at the end, and you can always guess to who it will be, blah, blah, blah. But this one starts with someone being murdered, and then they take off the screen mask, and you're like, oh, I was thinking, wow, they're going to go down a route where you know who the killer is throughout, but the characters within the film don't. And I thought that'd be really, really interesting. But no, that was a sort of red herring in itself, because that character ends up dying. So it never really pushes the genre as much as it kind of, with all its self-referential commentary, they all end up being pretty much of a muchness. So that was Scream 6. Chris, I know, has watched or is watching One Piece, the Netflix live action retelling of the manga and anime. I know you're also going to watch it.
Yeah.
I thought I would give it a go, at least the first episode. I got 15 minutes in.
Yeah.
It's basically, as far as I can understand, a fantasy adventure. There's a character who's called Luffy, I think. And he is basically wants to become king of the pirates, and they're all these pirates across the land are searching for the One Piece, which is basically some treasure. I thought, okay, cool, fine, I can watch a sort of fantasy adventure. It's very, for a show that's actually rated 15, it's there are some violent parts of it, but the tone of it was very childish.
It seems that way, yeah.
Which I guess is maybe inherent because of the manga and anime. And, you know, I fully didn't expect this to be like a, like a Game of Thrones or anything like straight-laced like that. I knew it'd be a bit sort of OTT. But when the character... Have you seen any of the anime?
Bits and pieces here and there, yeah.
Okay, so I hope this isn't a spoiler because it happens within the first 10 minutes.
Mm.
But he gets hit and he stretches.
Yeah.
And then there's a point where he stretches his arm so far out to like go and punch someone. I was like, nah, this is not for me. I just turned it off. I was like, nah, I'm done.
I'm done.
I gave it a go. Up until that point, I was like, I can watch like a silly kind of pirate adventure, like, fine. But when he starts fucking powering up his fist and like stretching it out, I was like, nah, I'm done.
Is it bad, or you just thought, nah, this is so stupid, or what?
I was just like, oh, fuck, nah, I can't watch this. He gets hit in the head with a mace and it fucking bounces off. I was like, nah.
Oh, it's a joke.
This is Mr. Fantastic. This is the Wish Mr. Fantastic, mate. It's fucking... I was done.
Yeah, I had a feeling, to be fair, that it wouldn't be your jam, to be fair. But
yeah, no, I gave it a go.
You tried.
But look, I am not the target audience for this. Chris very much is. He said in our group chat that he thinks it's the best live action adaptation of a anime. I don't think it's a very high bar, but that is good praise. So next time he's on the pod, I'm sure he can wax lyrical about it. I'm not going to really say too much about it because, like I said, I'm not the target audience. But, yeah. Interested to hear what you will think of it. I don't know how you are for time, but we can sort of finish with a chat on Ahsoka.
Sure.
Which I always mispronounce, but I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. So this is the...
What episode do you want, quickly?
I've seen all four.
Okay, I haven't seen episode four, so...
Okay.
Episode four, please.
Okay. Try to remember what happened, because not much happens, really.
I heard it was quite a good episode, people will say.
No, I just mean generally in the series so far.
Oh, got you, sorry.
So this is the latest Disney Plus Star Wars series set in the Mandoverse, show run and written by Dave Filoni. It follows Ahsoka Tano, who was the Padawan to Anakin Skywalker. So she's a Jedi, but she sort of left the Jedi sort of regime. Starts with her coming across a map, which seemingly reveals the location of someone called Ezra and possibly Grand Admiral Thrawn. There's a few sort of side characters, which I think if you've ever watched Clone Wars or Rebels, you will recognize. I don't, but Sabine and Hera. And then there's Baylan, who's sort of Sith. I don't know if he's a Sith, but he seems like a Sith. And his sort of Padawan Shin. And yeah, essentially, they get the map, they lose the map, they try and get the map back, and Balin, who gets the map, manages to figure out where it leads, and then sets about trying to get him and his cronies to that location to help bring back the rise of Grand Admiral Thrawn. That's more and less the plot, and more and less what happens over the first three episodes. I think it's pretty boring, if I'm being brutally honest. I quite liked Ahsoka when she appeared in Mandalorian season 2. But yeah, this series is doing absolutely nothing for me so far.
That is not an unfair comment. I think it's all right. I think the first episode was quite boring. Because they were kind of like, I suppose, trying to set the scene, I guess, trying to let us know a bit more about kind of Ahsoka's situation, kind of, I guess, and like setting the scene for like what the, setting up what the season is going to be about, I guess, and all like the extra side characters and stuff. And I was like, yeah, this is cool, whatever. Episode two, I thought was a bit better. I think it was a bit more action. There was a couple of decent lightsaber fights in that, I believe. And I thought it was pretty cool. One thing I think the series, in the first three episodes at least, hasn't done a good enough job of is telling us about people who haven't finished Clone Wars or watched Clone Wars or watched Rebels or whatever. They haven't done a good enough job of telling us why Ahsoka's left the Jedi Order or why she left the Jedi Order. What about her and her morals and her ideologies is different to that of the Jedi. Like, why is she different to any of the, you know, your Mace Windus, your Luke Skywalkers, whatever, and what forced her to leave, and kind of like, I would love to know what more of a story behind that as somebody who hasn't finished Clone Wars or Rebels. I find I've watched some of Rebels, so I know who Sabine is, I know who Hera is, I know who Chopper is, you know, people like that. So seeing them in live action was cool, / part of it looks like cosplay. So I was kind of like half digging it, half not digging it, because I don't know, I just think it was a little bit off-putting, I think, in the first episode. Now get a bit more used to it, so I think I'm warming up to it a little bit, especially for Hera. I think Hera looks a bit odd in live action. I like, is it Baylor or Balin? Which is it?
Balin, yeah.
Balin. I like Balin, even though he's, in the first episode, he's had about four lines combined. I like the idea of him, because I think, I don't know if you agree, but his lightsaber is not red. It's like dark orange. So I think,
okay.
I think he's not like fully a Sith. I think he's a Jedi who just doesn't, who left the Jedi Order and is now just kind of doing stuff for the sake, like, doing stuff for money, basically. I think there's a line at the end of the episode 2 or episode 1 where this witch woman, Elsbeth, where her name is, says, oh yeah, I want you to kill Ahsoka Tano. And he's like, oh, that'd be a shame, because, like, you know, there's so few Jedi left. And it wasn't like a thing of, like, he's evil and wants to, like, it wasn't like a, what's her name in Obi-Wan? What's her name? Oh, played by Moses Ingram. What is her name?
Don't know.
Wow. Yeah, can't remember her name. But it wasn't like her where she was like, Obi-Wan, I'm gonna fucking kill you. or Anakin, I'm gonna fucking
murder. Reaver.
Reaver, thank you. Where she was like hell bent on revenge, because she was like, fuck you lot. Like, the Jedi fucked us, so fuck the Jedi, I'm gonna kill everybody. Including Luke Skywalker, who's a defenseless child. Anyway, Balin's like, he seems someone to me who's like, do you know what, I actually don't mess with either the Sith or Jedi, but for the right price, you know, I'm a, what's it called, I'm a hired hand, which is interesting, because he also has a Padawan who I don't, who seems more on it with, like, she's barely had any lines either. She looks quite unhinged, I will say.
Oh yeah, she's got the crazy about her.
Yeah. And she looks more, very much more like, I just want to kill Jedis. Like, anyone who even has a hint of the Force who's not Sith, I want them dead. That's what she seems like. Whereas I think the Master is a bit more like, do you know what? I'm actually kind of cool with everybody, but if you pay me to kill someone, I'll kill them. Like, it is what it is. So I'm interested that, I hope we get a bit more into their background and kind of like their chemistry and their relationship with each other. Because I think that potentially sounds very interesting and a bit more just in terms of like, you know, Jedi Sith relations, I think, is interesting. What I'm not digging about the show is I find Ahsoka really boring character.
She has no personality.
None at all, which is a shame because when she appears in what's it called, in Mandalorian, I was like, oh mate, she's sick. Like that episode she was in Mandalorian is one of my favorite episodes of the Mandalorian. I thought she was great in that, and in Clone Wars Rebels, she is, I suppose, in Clone Wars, she's a bit more of like a vibrant, as far as I can see, a vibrant, enthusiastic character. In Rebels, she is a bit more reserved, I guess, because I suppose things have happened. She's left the Jedi Order by that point, blah, 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 blah. But in this, she just seems so stoic and so wooden, and I'm assuming it's the direction she's been given, but to me, and it does kind of like resemble that old Jedi master apprentice relationship kind of thing that we've seen throughout Star Wars throughout however many decades. But to me, it's just like, it's not appealing. I don't find it very appealing.
No, you can't warm to the central character.
No.
Which, ironically, you warm more to the Mandalorian, even though he's behind a mask for 90% of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's they haven't quite nailed that. I'm hoping maybe as time goes on, we will, I don't know, get to know her. Maybe she'll loosen up a little bit, and maybe we'll, like, you know, she'll be a bit more fun. I don't know, but I'm interested in the whole Sabine situation in terms of like her not really having any Force capabilities so far as we're aware, but them still training her to be a Jedi. And I think it's actually, interestingly enough, leans into, I suppose, the more Rian Johnson Last Jedi side of it, where it's like, actually, anybody can wield the Force. Anybody can be a Jedi. You don't have to be from a special lineage, blah, 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 blah. So I'm curious to know if at the end of the series she does, even if it's just a little bit, have a bit of use of the Force. But I think that would be quite interesting. And I hope they'll go into that a little bit more. I imagine she will, I don't know, be able to move something at some point. I don't know. Yeah, and then there's all this witchcraft stuff with Morgan, Elsbeth, I think is her name, or whatever her name is, who was in The Mandalorian as well, season two.
She was
the woman that Ahsoka was fighting in the, I think, right? Or am I making up? In that episode that Ahsoka first turned up in. I think she's that woman she was fighting, right? On the river. I could be wrong.
Well, I know.
But
I didn't recognise her, but
maybe I'm wrong. But regardless, the idea of, I guess, introducing witchcraft or whatever she's into Star Wars, I think is also quite interesting. I hope they delve into that a bit more. But my worry is that, like, all these little aspects of little things that I'm finding slightly interesting will not lead up to one overall project that I find interesting in general. I feel like stuff might get left by the wayside, stuff might not even get answered at all for the overall purpose of this series, which I think will be, we need to find Admiral Thrawn and we need to find Ezra Bridger, which I think will eventually just take over this whole series. How interested in that I am, I'm not entirely sure. I think that Thrawn is supposed to be the eventual big bad of the Mandoverse in terms of like the films that are coming out. So I'm curious to see how he's portrayed. And how he's introduced into live action. But other than that, I am lukewarm on the series as a whole. I think it's okay, but I'm not loving it, I would say. That being said, I haven't seen episode 4, which apparently everyone's really gassed about. So
I don't really see why. Well, I can see why. Anyway. watching. Yeah, I mean, it is just boring. boring. There's not really too many side quests, which I think is fine because that sort of distracts Mandalorian from its main purpose. But what they're currently spent 4 episodes on the same thing, and yeah, I'm not finding it that interesting, to be honest. But I will. Well, they're releasing the 5th episode in cinemas.
Is it?
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. What, in the UK as well?
I'm not sure. I saw it on Twitter, but I didn't know I didn't notice if it was an American account or a UK account. But yeah, I might see how I feel after episode 5.
Yeah, fair play. I will say as well, there was a couple of visuals as well that I thought were pretty cool too, especially in episode 3. Like, there was like these space whales. I don't know what they're called in real life, but I thought they were visually really well done. I'm trying to think of some other positives. There was a lightsaber fight in episode 1, which was cool, I thought, between Sabine and the Padawan.
Yeah, but she gets stabbed, but...
Oh, she lives!
Doesn't matter anymore, does it?
Literally, lightsabers are actually not lethal anymore. Like, they're not... The only person I've known to ever get killed by a lightsaber is Qui-Gon Jinn.
Yeah.
Everyone else lives. Like, it's not fair. Like, justice for Qui-Gon, that's what I'm saying.
Exactly, justice for Qui-Gon. Yeah, so that's a series that's ongoing, and we will keep talking about it. And by the time it ends, I think Loki will be out, or, you know, I can't imagine they'll cross over, but yeah, that's in the pipeline. I don't know what else is coming out that you're interested in going to view.
What, in on Disney Plus or in?
No, just in general. Any film? General.
There is a film called The Creator. I don't know if you've seen the trailers. I think we talked about it. I think, but John David Washington's in it.
That's it. Yeah.
And that looks pretty cool. And I am like a jilted ex-lover because I'm willing to give John David Washington another chance to prove to me that he is a good actor.
And I'm gonna let you down.
I really like. And yeah, I think that looks like pretty hard sci-fi, which I'm digging more and more. I'm getting more and more into sci-fi stuff, so I'm quite looking forward to that. Other than that, there's not really a lot else. I don't think, not in this coming month. I don't know. You can maybe tell me otherwise.
I'll consult the Oracle. That is my Odeon app. Other brands are available, blah, blah, blah. We have The Nun 2. Can't imagine you're going to see that.
Absolutely not.
My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3. Did that skip a sequel, or did I just miss that? The Meg 2.
I'm not seeing that. Sarah wanted me to go and see that. With her, because I think Chris said he wouldn't go with her. There's no chance I'm watching The Meg 2.
Oh my god. Sure. Did you ever watch Haunted Mansion?
I think I might have, yeah, back in whenever it first came out, yeah.
What, like 2 weeks ago?
No, not that. Oh, I thought you meant, isn't there like a previous one?
Yeah, no, there's a live action one, or I don't know if it's
ever announced. Yeah, I saw the trailer for the newer one and it looks shit, so I'm not going to watch it.
Yeah. I think they missed a trick not releasing that at Halloween, which I guess explains why The Nun 2 is coming out, although we're only at the beginning of September. There's also an anime coming out called The First Slam Dunk.
Oh, I actually watched that on Saturday.
Oh, is it any good?
It was okay, yeah, it was decent. It was quite different from any other sports anime I've watched, in that it was actually like... So, I don't know how much, if you've watched any sports anime, but very much it's like they will hyper-focus on certain things and like, oh my god, he's using his special free kick technique, which he developed at the Academy of da-da-da-da, right? And it's very cheesy in that way, in terms of like, they treat sports like people who have superpowers.
Okay.
But The First Slam Dunk is just like, it's just like a regular... It's just like a regular film. Like, I was because I've only seen the trailers for it, so I didn't really know what it was like about. But it's like about a basketball team, and they're like, it's just going through like a championship game, and it's like going back into all like the characters and their personalities and in their past and what they had to deal with and their way to the finals and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, this is actually just like a regular film, but just animated. Which I enjoyed for what it was. But yeah, I don't know. I just didn't expect it to be that sort of style. I expected it to be very much more cheesy anime style.
Okay.
But yeah, it was okay. It was cool. I'd watch a series of it, but because like the film to me, it was like the end of a series.
Okay.
Because like they have a game, you know, afterwards, you know, show some of them like in college and stuff. And I'm like, oh, okay. Whereas I thought it was going to be like showing the start of their journey, it showed the end of their journey. So I was like, oh, this is interesting. But yeah, if it was a TV show, I'd probably watch it because I like the sports stuff like that.
Cool. Just looking at the coming soon, and there's nothing jumping out at me.
I've seen Expendables 4, which if I'm desperate, I'll go watch.
I'm not even sure I've seen Expendables 3.
I've seen one Expendables, and I remember I watched it in Pearly Way. Croydon View Cinema, and by the time we got out, I'm pretty sure I was with Chris, or maybe I wasn't. By the time we got out, there was no trams and no buses. We had to walk from Pearly Way to East Croydon, which is a long fucking
walk. I've done that. That is a sketchy walk. Oh my god, I'm pretty sure it was Chris that led me through all the alleys and stuff. I was like, are you gonna murder me? sketchy as heck. Did not enjoy that walk at all. Pearly Way is not the one. There's also, surprisingly, your man, what's the bloke who does all the... Kenneth Branagh. Another one of those Agatha Christie films. I saw that one came out last year.
It looks like a horror film.
Yeah, it's a 12, so it's not going to be that bad. But it might be a bit spooky, but it's a Haunting in Venice. Another ensemble star-studded cast where he puts on a shit Belgian accent and presumably everyone gets 5 minutes of screen time, a line or two, and then it's the person who you expect. But
I also filmed those films back to back. This one and the last one. It only came out not long ago.
Yeah, I thought that. Unless that one was delayed because of COVID or something, maybe. You've also got the Lord of the Rings Extended Editions coming out on... Fuck me, the Return of the King's 4 hours 23 minutes.
It is, but it's like that's like half an hour. Half an hour of that is like credits.
Oh, okay. And then Girls Trip's coming out. Saw 10. Joyride. Did I watch Joyride?
No.
Did I watch that? No, I don't think I did.
Okay.
Saw 10, you gonna watch that?
Absolutely not, no. It's good to do Saw films.
Yeah.
What, they're finished?
Even bloody Chris Rock did one.
I watched that one. I watched it, yeah. And I was...
Why did you watch that?
I don't know. I think because Chris Rock was in it. So I was like, oh, how bad could it be? Chris Rock's in it. And it's still like, my palms are sweating. Knees, weak arms are heavy. Well, I'm a sweat already.
Mum's spaghetti. Yeah.
Exactly.
Were you nervous?
I was, mate.
She looked calm and ready. Shit, we're probably...
If I'll go bar for bar with you ever then, mate,
to be fair, I'm just worried that if anyone listens to this, we might get sued for copyright infringement. So all rights are reserved by Marshall Mathers III. You know. But yeah, okay, cool. So what we're basically saying is there's not much coming out that we're excited to watch, but... No. We will endeavour to bring content anyway. On that note, thank you for listening. You can follow us on X, where we are at YSC Podcast 17. Nice. We're on TikTok and Instagram as Your Average Critics, and you can find previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. God,